Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper with olives. That's an inside joke, sorry. I am your host, Eddie Van Wevin. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Fear Not Williams.
Listen, I take no sides in any arguments that occurred before this podcast started.
Yeah. Also with us is intern slash part-timer Amy.
I'm being harassed. I'm talking to HR.
No, as long as it wasn't recorded, we're fine. We got a great show in stores. We're going to be talking about the recently dropped A24 film from Ari Aster, and that is Bo is Afraid. So stick around as we dive into this movie. This movie really kind of took us for a loop, and I don't really think we've kind of come down yet from it, so... So stick with us as we dive into that. But before we do, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out over at our website where we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thriller, horror. If you're looking for it, we got it. Tune in on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, you can check us out wherever podcasts are streaming. And that is Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart, Pandora. You can tune into your heart's desire wherever those, wherever you can find those apps. Download them. Look for us at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe. Listen to our episodes. Listen to our thoughts. And let us know what you think. If you think we're worth it, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Amy wants another olive juice bag.
No.
Oh, we have so much fun here. Amy, are you salty like the brine?
When was I not?
We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. What you had missed right before we went on the air.
I was violently harassed and assaulted.
So
with a bag.
So let me give a little backstory here. So I like salty snacks. What is that? What was that?
I remember that character from Mad TV.
Yeah, was it Miss Kwan?
No. It was a different one.
That was the Stewart's mom.
The Stewart's mom, because Miss Kwan was Alex Borstein. Yeah, yes, and she was a lot higher.
So anyway, I like salty snacks. Mm-hmm. And right before we came to the studio, I pretty much emptied half of a jar of olives into a Ziploc bag. And took it with me to the studios. I like green olives. I've always liked green olives. So I had the Ziploc bag and I was eating the olives. I shared them with Spencer. Amy doesn't like olives or green olives. She only likes black olives. Weird. So
Kalamatas are purple. I like purple olives.
Those
too.
Taste like the green olives. You don't like Kalamata olives.
I like Kalamata olives.
Anyway.
You don't know my life.
So. In the midst of our conversation, Amy is getting a little huffy when it comes to the conversation that we're going to be having because there are certain facets of this film that really do lean heavily into her particular culture and tradition. And it's not just a stereotype. It's not any of that, because even Nathan Lane has spoken about it, about this film. But either way... So we were talking and Amy's going back and forth being the intern. And so I happened to have the empty bag of olives that only
with
had
juice.
That only had a little bit of juice left in it. And she
I
was
went to
talking
say something
and she
and you flung it straight at my. No, don't you don't get no, to this I, part of the narrative I get to do.
I gingerly tossed it thinking it wasn't going
to. Gingerly.
Not thinking.
Squarely.
Not thinking
squarely,
that the.
Squarely.
I can mute you from
glasses.
Here.
Yes, you can. And guess what? I could run to another microphone.
Okay, there's only one other one that's
to
worried.
Be fair to everyone here. To say the word gingerly
yeah.
is not what that word was meant for.
There's a lot of juice, and the momentum took the bag. Look.
Don't. Stop trying to.
That's not gingerly.
The momentum took the bag.
That was also. Did you see that toss was like trying to push something, a piece of paper across the desk?
You're about to get juice all over this new studio table.
Do you know what? I got beamed.
Do you know what?
I got beamed between the eyes in the middle of the forehead with this bag.
With a small sandwich bag, Ziploc bag.
I like how you're really trying to downplay this after.
Oh, I hit her in the head with a bag. I'm not denying that.
Full of juice.
The fact is of how hard she was hit. It was not, you know.
I started crying. You were laughing hysterically.
I wasn't the only one.
Spencer didn't throw it. He can laugh as much as he wants. I did not throw it.
Because I laughed in shock.
Yeah, it was. And then it just kept going. And then neither of you could stop. And this is where we are currently. This sound is just the delightful noise of me talking while they laugh.
Oh, Amy.
Oh, intern.
With green olive juice on your face.
Oh, Jiminy.
Look, it was an accident. It was not intentional. If you let me explain. Dang, judge, jury, and executioner over here. Look, I gingerly tossed it. It had a little bit of oomph because of the momentum. It landed on your face.
You played baseball. I didn't.
Yeah, this isn't rookie of the year, okay? We didn't float the ball in.
You could have floated.
Yeah, no.
Rookie of the year.
By the way, that was the dumbest way to ever tell somebody to pitch in the major leagues in terms of, like, if you're somebody who's standing in the middle of the pitcher's mound and your mother says to float the ball, that's essentially a soft pitch. That is a meatball of a hit. That's going to hit a home.
Okay, so we're talking about that 90s movie.
Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, I will hear no ill will towards that movie. Even though I know you're correct, I will not hear.
Why?
Ooh, I'd actually like to know about that.
Because I love that movie.
Aww. Oh my God.
You love Chet Stedman?
What? Oh, Amy, that's a deep pull.
Hey, you can't unfold that one. The mom's name is Mary.
I don't remember that. Wasn't that Nick Nolte? No. That was. Yeah. What? It was Nick Nolte?
Nick Nolte.
Charlie, we're going to go play throw balls.
No, yeah, that's really, really, you know, the kind of guy you want. You know, someone who.
Yeah, you want Nick Nolte in your kids' movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. How else are you going to learn about Major League?
The only thing that anybody will ever remember from that movie, the only thing of actual true value from that film is three words. Funky butt loving. That's it.
Funky butt loving?
The thing I remember is break your arm and it will heal in a way that will get you into the major.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's in their garage, every teenager at the time with a hammer in their arm outstretched. It's got to break so it can do the snap, Mom. It's got to do the snap. Yeah, no. Either way, we got olive juice to the face over here. We got rookie of the year fanatic over here. We have a great show in store.
Yeah, we do.
We did want to mention, so we were going to talk about how we actually did go out all together to go see a movie that we thought was going to be pretty interesting.
It's Ghibli Fest. Let's start there. Which Ghibli Fest seems to be going on for forever now. Like, was it always just the entire year?
No. It was like a season.
Right.
It was usually like just a month.
And I thought it was even like just the summer. Like it was once, like literally it was like late spring to midsummer or late spring.
She said midsummer.
And I didn't say midsummer. Or just like summer. But this is like, it's going till October this year.
Yeah, I saw
something.
That.
They run a collection of Ghibli movies in theaters. You can see it Japanese dubbed or English dubbed. And they vary. And this year they also threw in, then they upped it to 4 days instead of 2 days, the theatrical production of Spirited Away.
Not the
theatrical.
It's a stage production. Yeah. So it's a stage production. Because you say theatrical in a movie theater, it typically means the variation of the film suited for theaters. Because there is extended cuts, there's director's cuts. So you have to be correct.
Talk about the theater, it's still theatrical.
You're the intern. So, no, I'm just saying, no, that has to have context. You can't just say theatrical and not have people think, oh, you mean the one that was in the theaters?
You would say a movie.
You didn't give context that it was a stage production.
It's a theatrical production. I don't say that the movie that we're going to be reviewing is a theatrical production. It was not done in a theater on a stage. I will Webster this. Continue.
So anyway, we decided to go and check this movie out. Spencer fell asleep halfway through.
It was very nice, though.
No, it was interesting. I don't think Ghibli should adapt their movies to the stage.
I wonder if someone from Disney talked them into this. Because
maybe. I mean, that might have been something that maybe they caught on to. I don't know if they were convinced by somebody, maybe by the impact Disney has. Because Disney's productions typically go either to their theme parks for their theater house or Broadway. This one was done in the London. Wasn't it done in London?
No. This was done in Japan at the National Theater.
Oh, okay. Either way, it wasn't done here. Right. So who knows? I mean, maybe, but I feel like there should be a clear line of what should and shouldn't be adapted in terms of like things like this. And Ghibli movies just should not be adapted.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like while watching this movie, there were certain things that like when you see the actual anime, it makes more sense than seeing it on a stage production.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to translate some of the crazy imagery that happened in that movie over.
Like, there was a lot of things that I was like, I definitely know I like the movie better. Like the parts with the people being turned into pigs and some of the scenes where like they're transitioning from place to place. I mean, not to mention you have really big set pieces in the movie. It's really hard to kind of make that work on a stage that's limited in size. So there were a few pluses about it. Like I like some of the puppetry work, the, you know, practical effect work. But I think all in all, I don't think they should be making any more. I don't know. What do you think, Amy? Because you're looking at me blankly.
Oh, I'm not looking
at you. Unless you're staring at the olive juice on your glasses.
Rude. No, I was actually, I had looked up the meaning of the word theatrical production.
Oh my God. So, you're still dying on this hill.
Very clearly. She was looking that up.
Because it refers to a play, opera, or musical that is performed live on a stage for an audience.
Yes. Now put that word in terms of film, in terms of movie theaters. Mm-mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can shake your head all you want, but you know what?
Performers for a particular time at audience. No. But in regards to your question about should Ghibli do more live stage productions of their movies? No. I think we actually had this conversation because there was a commercial for the My Neighbor Totoro one that went to West End.
That's the one that was in London.
Oh. That either it was in front of a movie or I think you had sent it to me and you're like, this seems cool. And it was like the giant Totoro. Like, it looked really interesting. But again, I'm kind of in that same boat that while there was a lot of good that came out of this, it was more difficult if you didn't know, like, coming into it, to sit there and be like, okay, so they're running around doors. Why are they running around doors?
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
And I was like, oh, if you don't know like all the sequences, things that are going on while this is happening and the actual imagery that goes along with that, you're just like,
Either way, it's one of those ones that I don't think we'll be revisiting anytime soon. And maybe we'll touch a little bit more on it during the month of anime. As we delve closer to that month.
I mean next week.
Well, we're not doing it next week. So.
No, but May is, it's going to be May.
Yeah. You sure about that one?
Next week, yeah.
You got something there on your face. But that brings us to our main conversation of the evening, and that is our review of A24's recently released film, Bo is Afraid. This movie was, first off, this movie was difficult to find in theaters around here because of the fact of its limited release. I don't know if it's because, you know, maybe the theaters know something we don't, or it just wasn't, you know, promoted as much. But also, this movie is 3 hours long. So I can see why people were kind of hesitant to put it in their movie.
They sat through Endgame.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, but that was Marvel. And people were like,
losing their minds.
we're not going to get into that's another whole conversation in itself.
I think I left a drunken message on your answering machine after that movie.
On my answer? What is this, Seinfeld? No, yes. On my, you mean in my voicemail?
It was an answering machine.
Anyway.
This movie.
So this movie, before we jump into it, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Bo Wasserman is a mild-mannered but paranoid-ridden man who embarks on a surreal odyssey to get home to his mother, confronting his greatest fears along the way.
Written, directed, and co-produced by Ari Aster, the film stars Joaquin Phoenix, Patti LuPone, Nathan Lane, Amy Ryan, Kylie Rogers, Parker Posey, Stephen McKinley Henderson, Haley Squires, Michael Gandolfini, Zoe Lister-Jones, and Richard Kind. It also had a slew of other cameos that we'll talk about as we go on. A couple key pieces about the film. The film was initially described by director and writer Ari Aster as a, quote, four-hour-long nightmare comedy. The runtime of the theatrical cut runs just 1 minute shy of 3 hours. You hear that part, the theatrical cut?
They didn't say production.
Anyway,
said
Bo
cut.
Is Afraid was initially meant to be released sometime in 2022, but was delayed until the year after because, according to Aster, quote, it is not finished. I am a perfectionist. I take the entire manufacturing process very seriously, despite time and money restrictions. It's becoming more and more clear with a lot of these types of performers or directors that, like, the, what's his name? The one who did Stanley Kubrick, that whole mindset of that type of director is becoming more and more of the common theme that we're hearing with most directors nowadays, being tedious and making sure everything has to be like absolutely perfect. So for A24, that seems to be right on brand, you know, but it also makes sense, especially if you're making movies like Hereditary and Midsommar and all these other ones that he's done. Like, you would have to be in order for you to not be considered, like, clinically insane. One last piece of information that was a little bit fun. Nathan Lane described the movie as, quote, the Jewish everything everywhere all at once, and, quote, an epic tale of guilt and codependency, the story of his life, end quote. So Nathan Lane does have a role in the film, which is really, it was really fun to see. To be quite honest, I wasn't too sure, and we'll get into like expectations in a bit, but like one of the things I was definitely not aware of was the full cast of people in this movie. So earnestly, seeing all these people show up, and it was actually a pretty cool thing, pretty good delight. So talking about this movie, we are going to dive into spoilers because honestly, you can't really talk about this movie without going into spoilers.
You have to.
The whole nature of this movie is literally contingent on like a few key things that essentially blow the whole story out of the water, like in terms of giving up the goods. So unfortunately, this will be a spoiler filled review, but nevertheless, enjoy the conversation and you have been warned. So let's talk expectations. Unfortunately, the exposure here to Ari Aster films is limited here at this table. Amy has only seen the one with Bo is Afraid.
I snuck out on that one.
Spencer has only seen Hereditary.
Yeah.
And I've seen Hereditary and Midsommar, which I believe there's more movies. I'm more than certain, but...
For him?
No, yeah, for him.
No, it's only those two.
He's
technically now three.
No, there's like other movies outside of A24 that he's done. Are you not aware of that? Or?
Well, if he has, okay.
But most of them are shorts, though, from this list I just pulled. He's got 11 director credits, and yeah, actually all of them are shorts.
Hey, so we're in good... Well, I'm in good standing. Which is interesting, because there was a conversation about someone who had mentioned that this movie may have been a... speaking of shorts, a continuation or spiritual sequel to his movie from 2011 called Bo, which was a short film, which is interesting because the synopsis for this movie says an erotic middle-aged man's trip to visit his mother is delayed indefinitely when his keys are mysteriously taken from his door. He is subsequently haunted by an increasingly sinister chain of upsetting events. So this does look like it. What the? Although it is not made apparent in the film, it should be said that Bo once used a Ouija board. Okay. Yeah. I'm not too sure about, like, what the relationship is between that one and this movie. But it does seem like there's a lot of correlating evidence. Okay, the movie was speculated to be an expansion of a short film entitled Bo from 2011, as well as a theatrical adaptation of a leaked 2014 draft script, also entitled Bo is Afraid, both directed and written respectively by Astor. This was later confirmed as many scenes. Oh, so it is. Okay, so it's just a continuation, kind of like how Guillermo del Toro did a film adaptation of the short film Mama. So just expanded upon the story of it. So that's good to know.
The emergency thing that had gone on that we had talked about.
The short emergency,
then they turned it
into... The one from last year for Sundance, I think.
I thought it was Sundance.
Sundance or TIFF. The one that went to Amazon. But either way, so let's talk expectations. So with the knowledge that you do have pertaining to, for Amy, pertaining to what you've seen from A24 and from what you have seen about this film, what were some of your expectations going into this movie?
Well, we can just kind of skip A24 and talk about my expectations from the vague implications and or multiple like Watch Mojo sequences they try to put in for scary things from Midsommar, mostly Midsommar.
So you're basing your expectations on
a singular movie from this director that I have a very vague understanding of, which was... My expectation was, I don't know if I'm going to like this movie, but I'm willing to try because I really like A24. And if I am scared out of my pants, that will be problematic. But I'm here to try.
Well, there you go. Spencer, with your limited knowledge of the films that you know from Ari Aster as well as A24, as well as... Because here's the thing. I didn't see any promotional stuff about this movie. Like, I had to search it out. Like, typically when I'm looking on YouTube or whatever, stuff pops up. Like ads, trailers, stuff like that. I don't really recall seeing anything for this movie. So what about you?
No, I'm mostly just the trailer for this movie before another movie, some point within the last couple of months. That's really the only time I've seen this. But to be fair, I do not have ads on YouTube because I don't care for them. Oh my God. So yeah, going into this movie, I was like, A24 can be kind of all over the place in the things they think are good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, this could be, like, a really good scary movie. I didn't even know, like, from the trailers, I was like, I can't tell if what, like, where this is even trying to fall in the genre. But I didn't really look anything up either because I like being surprised. So, really, just kind of going in willing to be surprised is where I landed.
Yeah.
What about you?
Honestly, I like I said, I hadn't seen a lot of, you know, the promotional stuff for this movie. I've seen bits and pieces, like little snippets, but all from, you know, either reviews that people have either done on their own or the vague mentions during like film festival season, things like that. Nothing to the extent of like a full-blown trailer or even a gander at like the cast list for this movie. From what I know through Ari Aster, he is a very meticulous storyteller who puts a lot of little Easter eggs in his movie that you wouldn't typically think are Easter eggs, but they end up becoming after somebody's examined a scene for so long or whatever. Like there's a scene in Midsommar where the main protagonist, the young lady in that movie, actually played by Florence Pugh, they're in the town, the little village that they're visiting, and there's a scene where you can see the trees off in the distance on this ridge, and the trees actually make the shape of her sister's face, which is really interesting. But a lot of things like that. But I also know that he's no stranger to brutality and, you know, graphic violence in certain scenes. So it's a toss-up. Honestly, I was kind of concerned that at the time we were watching this movie and the nature of what was going to be in it, like, I was kind of worried I was going to give myself nightmares. Thankfully, you know, that wasn't the case. But Either way, it's always a concern when it comes to an A24 movie. I think Amy had said it at one point in time, you're either going to get a really sad movie or you're going to get a really scary movie. So it was a toss up for me. But speaking of actually seeing the movie, first impressions. Let's talk first impressions in the most concise way possible. Amy, what were some of your first impressions?
I will not swear, but literally that was like, I think I, because we all saw it together, mind you, it was a really late showing, and I'm fairly certain I turned to Spencer and was like, what did I just watch? And there were expletives included in that statement, but it was a version of what did I just watch? And I needed to have a lot of time to process to come to any type of a conclusion or to be able to even say what I feel about this movie, which will be expanded upon later.
There you go. Spencer.
I just needed to get out of there. The movie ended and I just felt so hot. Like, I felt like I had just come out of a sickness and like I had finished, like, you know, being delusional, and I was really thirsty after the movie also. So like, it just felt like a sickness had passed and it was over. And that's how my first impression of this movie is.
Wow, those are pretty strong feelings. Okay. All right. Well,
What's your first impression?
My first impression is I have to say this is probably the tamest of the Ari Aster A24 movies. Because Hereditary was just on a whole another level of like chaos and supernaturalness and beheadings. And then Midsommar is just brutal in many sequences. So this movie actually was the calmer of the three, but the intensity of the driving story was right up there with the rest of them. Like, I have to say that this movie really did surprise me, because you honestly go in with no idea. Like, you think it's one thing, and then the movie shifts gears right from the get-go and gives you like a first surprise and then another surprise and another surprise, and then you're like, wait, what is happening? And I left a little confused, but it got me thinking about it. And I think that's what decent movies do, is they create that conversation within yourself. And so in doing so with that, like, it was successful. It's just, there was a lot of questions I had to talk out loud to really kind of ground my own opinion into it. Which essentially that's what we're going to talk about right now. Because diving into this, you, like Spencer mentioned, you're introduced to Bo. Bo is a very, sheltered, seems like a very sheltered and like, what's another word for his, like a sheltered, ignorant wouldn't be the word. Like, what would
he's
you say,
subservient.
Amy?
Subservient. He has come to a point of being so, it's not even docile. He's legitimately just subservient. There's this expectation that everybody, like, he cannot stand up to anybody or everybody, and he is living in a constant and perpetual state of paranoia, fear, anxiety, uncertainty. Yeah. Like, he's a hot trash mess.
Yeah,
he dresses like a man boy.
and it's the movie, like, sincerely picks up right at the get go. Like, you have this.
He comes out the womb.
Oh yeah, I even forgot about that one. Like, it starts because it's interesting. It creates these chapters that are very. We'll get into the story. Sorry.
It creates chapters, but the initial sequence that comes out, which I think was, there was two places that I jumped. And the first one was the opening where literally he's coming out the womb, and it was so loud and so bright that it made me jump.
Yeah, she jumped. Let's talk performers. Joaquin Phoenix has always seemed to be some type of powerhouse of an actor, to put it bluntly. And I think it all started for me with him with Gladiator. Because he was such a deplorable person in that movie. it was such a good performance that I did not like him as a person. That's how bad it was for me, for Joaquin Phoenix. So it was interesting seeing his filmography as of that point up until now. And it just seems like everything that he does with this unique, innate sense of, you know, personal connection to the roles, and really does allow himself to be, you know, inundated into that world that he's, you know, that they're creating for him in the film. And in this one, I think he played that role perfectly. He was a very just, he was a grown pushover, is the best way to put it. Everybody literally just kind of led his life for him, whether by proxy or by direct impact. It was always a matter of him being told or him being forced to do something or act a certain way because of what they wanted. Wouldn't you agree, Spence?
Yeah, especially with some of the weirder moments in the movie where you're like, why is this man doing this thing right now? And that kind of just feeds into, like, he kind of, like, even though he wants some of his own things, like, he doesn't actually do the things he needs to in this movie to, like, you know, get them to happen.
Yeah.
He's just stuck with people.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of scenes where he's, like, either afraid of the homeless situation, which let's kind of mention the fact that this world that he's in is, like, both normal and not normal. Like, the way things, because the therapy sessions seem normal and I thought everything was fine. And then he goes outside and there are, like, there's, like, vendors or whatever. And then you see, like, someone on the street is selling guns and it's like, okay.
Okay, well, see, and this is where we're getting into the confusing part of the movie for me. Because, like, I can't tell what is actually happening. And I mean from, like, a reality perspective. Because, like, I don't think his actual neighborhood is like how it's shown.
Oh, no, I agree.
Because, like, I feel like it's just trying to, like, set up, like, for later on the movie that, like, Bo just sees things this way even though it's not this.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's a certain level of absurdity that Bo's world is that seems to not have any sense of reality in it. And knowing that he's on medication and his perspective of the world, we learn later on, is very skewed based on his mom wanting him to constantly be safe. And, you know, you kind of get the gist of it when he's younger and he's talking about how he doesn't eat this because of this thing, or the colors in it make, you know, create cancer, or he sees bugs in the chocolate, but there's no bugs in the chocolate. You know, there are things that we're getting glimpses of where his perspective is skewed because of what he's been taught all his life. So yeah, that's probably a little bit of truth to it. And we'll dive into that. What about you, Amy? What were your thoughts on Joaquin Phoenix's performance?
Well, considering that for the most part, I think one of the first times I saw him live action would have been Walk the Line.
Ah.
Because other than that, I knew he was Kenai. Hey. and I vaguely remember seeing Teenage Him, but I hadn't seen Gladiator until a couple of years ago. And then Her. So I'm vaguely aware of Joaquin Phoenix, but I've also been understanding the more that I see him in other things. Like, I hadn't even seen Signs since.
I was going to say, you just saw Signs just last year, I believe. Because we talked about it.
And you're like, it's fresh. She just saw it. But his performance and the way he approaches characters are very developed. He not only embodies whatever the character is, but he becomes very method, which in this, the story is kind of a million ways to Sunday, because you can take it a million ways to Sunday. But he really does a great job of embodying the unreliable narrative scope. Because not only do we see, like, literally everything flits across his face. The first phone call that he has with his mother about the difficulties that he has of why he cannot get to their however many, like, this visit. He carries all of these different emotions, and much like some other wide-eyed actors that we might have not talked about in the last episode, but we vaguely did. Looking at you, Nicholas Holt. And he's able to convey it with such not only believability, but genuine earnesty that when he finally starts facing down his fears in this nightmarish comedy landscape, as you might want to call it, I don't know. He does a really good job stepping from tableau to tableau to tableau to fantasy, nightmare, whatever have you. And he's as vaguely uncomfortable as it is, he's easy to watch. And I don't think anybody else would have come across with such commitment and dedication to the role if it had been in somebody else's hands. Like, I
agree with you on that one, because like, even though this movie is strange as all get out, mm-hmm. like he does a fantastic job right? of he selling does. This character. And like, I feel like that he is the main reason this movie works as well as it does, because he is able to sell his character in a way that makes you really want to question like what is actually going on in this movie.
Exactly.
And like, you will question that for 3 hours.
And then for a couple hours after it, when you're like, what did I just, I watched this, but I don't think it's what I was thinking I watched.
I watched it, but I don't think I watched it. Just, yeah, this movie really did keep you guessing in terms of what was reality based for Bo and what was not, and what parts were actually a part of the overall storyline for the main kind of plot drive of the end that we get to, and what is actually happening to him by chance. Because you come to find out, so as this film goes, you come to find out Bo is supposed to go see his mom the next day. He's put on a new prescription drug the day before by his therapist, who really emphasizes that he needs to take water with it. Through a couple of mishaps, unfortunately, where Bo loses his keys and he loses his luggage, he is unfortunately not able to make his flight to see his mom, and his mom becomes distraught over the phone. Later on, Bo finds out that his mom died of a chandelier falling on her head.
And decapitating her.
And ultimately decapitating, destroying whatever happened to her head. And so we have this whole like pilgrimage, if you will, of Bo trying to make the effort to go to where his mom is so that he can be there for the funeral. But a lot of things happen that kind of derail that journey, including becoming naked, running through the street, getting hit by a what looks to be like a food truck type truck, getting stabbed by a serial stabber, getting
birthday suit stabbed man.
Yeah.
That was the gimme name of the hour.
Getting chased through the forest by a former military person with PTSD, being adopted into a theater troupe in the middle of a forest, and then some, and whatever, whatnot. Like, it's a whole ordeal for this guy.
It's an odyssey.
And you don't know which parts are in like things that are supposed to be instances of him learn, like, because you don't know what the drive of the film is. Like, what's the point in some of those sequences where, as a filmmaker, what are you trying to imply with this scene or this act? And it's really difficult to kind of derive what exactly the director is trying to do at certain points, and what is just like, let's just throw in some pure madness into this mix, you know? So there's a lot that just really kind of makes everybody kind of go for a loop. What other performers did you guys want to highlight? I know Amy wants to talk about someone.
The last time you threw this to me, you got mad because I didn't talk about who you wanted
okay,
me to
talk
about.
Why don't we talk about, why don't we talk about really quick, because before we get to the mother, we have a couple other great performers that show their face in this film. We get a really wonderful cameo of Bill Hader as a
without his face on screen.
Yeah, who's hiding his face on screen is the UPS guy who finds his mom. Or decapitated body of his mom. We get a wonderful instance with Amy Ryan and Nathan Lane as Grace and Roger, respectively. Amy Ryan, if you're not aware, she played Holly on the last couple seasons of The Office. Mm-hmm. We already like her now. And then, of course, the wonderful Nathan Lane. If you don't know who Nathan Lane is, you should go really check your brain. Nathan Lane is wonderful. You should know who that person is.
And if you don't, we'll direct you towards your childhood of the voice of Timon from The Lion King.
Yep.
He is Albert in The Birdcage opposite Robin Williams, which is a fantastic movie. He has a weird cameo in Goldfinger. Yeah, no, Goldmember.
Goldmember.
Not finger. Goldmember. I was like,
hold up.
It's the Austin Powers, but he pretends to be like the talk, like the person that speaks on behalf of Beyonce. And he does this entire
giant. He's also the one who does the film adaptation of the most recent iteration, as well as the current, I believe it, I don't know if it's still going on, of The Producers with
Matthew Broderick.
Nathan Lane has done so much.
He's a treasure.
And yeah, he is. He was also in the much forgotten yet still interesting kids movie, supposedly, Mouse Hunt.
He was one of the brothers. He is also the voice of Scott Ledready in Teacher's Pet, which is available on Disney Channel.
Disney Plus.
Yeah. Sorry. It was on Disney Channel.
So Nathan Lane, he's been around.
He's got Tonys. He's got Grammys. He's got it all.
There's a few other people like Parker Posey, who plays Elaine. Parker Posey, if you don't really remember her, she did a really unique performance in Tom Hanks's You've Got Mail as the girlfriend, the first girlfriend for Tom Hanks in the film. I mean,
she was also Dr. Smith in the most recent iteration of Lost in Space.
That's right.
Oh, the one on Netflix?
Yeah, she was actually fantastic in that.
I didn't really see that one fully.
She's great.
Is she?
Yes.
I like how he emphasizes she's great. Everyone else sucks.
Because she's very manipulative in that series. And you're like, she can't get away with it. And she does.
She looks like she could be one of those types of people who would like manipulate the crap out of you and then turn around and say, it was nice seeing you with her hand on your shoulder.
Did you not get that from You've Got Mail? When she's literally, they're trapped in the elevator and she's,
where are my Tic Tacs?
When I get out of here, I'm getting my eyes lasered.
We get also a bunch of other wonderful roles with Richard Kind,
who plays
a lawyer. We also get the wonderful performance of the young Michael Gandolfini, son of the late James Gandolfini. He's the one who plays Young Bo. No, I'm sorry. He plays one of Bo's sons.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
So in that sequence. But yeah, I mean, this movie has a really great cast of characters. I think one of the great things that you can say about this movie is every time a new act or a new scene came in with a new face, it was really kind of a joy to see them. It was interesting, and I kind of appreciated the freshness of them coming into the fray. Like when you get introduced to Grace and Roger, Amy Ryan and you know, Nathan Lane's characters, honestly, I actually got excited. I'm like, oh, is Nathan Lane? All right. Craziness is over. Let's get a little normalcy in there.
You think it's craziness is over? Like, I think that's something also that's really, and not only indicative of the performances, but the enthusiasm at which he attacked this role was really apparent. Like that the interviews later on that Nathan Lane did regarding his part in this movie, he talks about where he was asking for more direction and kind of like, well, why is he this way? What, like, because he's a doctor in the movie, but he asked her, hey, like, so what is he a doctor? Like, is he really a doctor, or is it in his head? Is he a doctor? And he just says that, like, is he actually a veterinarian? And Nathan Lane actually, because Astor's like, I don't know, do whatever you want. Nathan Lane came up with an entire backstory for Dr. Roger so that he could have it to create like a convincing character. And I'm like, I appreciate that a lot. Cool. Also, he kept calling everybody my dude. And I was just like, oh no, am I that my annoying? Dude.
Yeah. And to hear Nathan Lane say it, it as odd as it sounds, it still had the unique balance of sounding like maybe he shouldn't say it and sounding like something that I would love to hear all the time. You know, it's weird because it's like when he says it, it's like, it's Nathan Lane. He said my dude. But you're like, ah, oh, he said my dude. So it's like, yeah,
honestly gave him a pass for pretty much any time he said anything in this movie.
and he's great in this movie. He's wonderful for the time that he's in there, because he is in there for one act. Him and Amy Ryan, they're in there for one act. But it's a good part of the film.
Yeah, it's a good part.
Also, and this is the one that I was kind of softballing up to Amy,
no, because she last time, a place to
last
stand.
Week, we talked about Renfield, lesson 352, and Amy tried to jump prematurely into Nicholas Holt when we were still talking about Nicholas Cage. And I said, speaking of which, who is the person Amy been wanting to talk about? Oh, I know who I want to talk about.
Ben Schwartz.
And no, that's not the
person. Okay, that's the person I wanted to talk about. But this person, you cannot ignore the multi-Grammy, multi-Tony winning actress that is the powerhouse that of Patti LuPone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is a literal and figurative beast on stage and screen.
So there was something that I had asked Amy before we went on air, because it interested me, because as we come to find out, and this is where spoiler territory comes into play, Patti LuPone, who plays the mom of Bo, actually fakes her own death in this grand scheme of testing her son's loyalty and fidelity towards her, and it's this kind of really skewed, manipulative.
It's not kind of manipulative. It's just straight up manipulative.
Extremely manipulative and overbearing kind of situation that he puts Bo through. But I had to ask Amy, has Patti LuPone ever done anything like this before?
Not to this extent. I mean, she has been. If you have a bit of musical theater background, you probably know who Patti LuPone is. We've had iterations of her as Mrs. Lovett multiple times for Sweeney Todd, which has a little bit of manipulation, but there's never been anything this aggressively. Like, she sank Renfield jokes. She sank her teeth into this part, and she didn't have to. It showed exactly what her acting chops have always been. There was nothing left. She left everything out on the table, and it was in such a great, despicable way that it was palpable. Mm-hmm. I think the only other time where we've had questions of her villainous prowess, I mean, she was the voice of Yellow Diamond for Steven Universe, which she's a little bit alarming in that, but that's all vocal performance. And then, yeah, other than that, and she's
right. She was, because the diamonds, they are essentially the antagonist, mm-hmm, for a good portion of the series. Yeah. I forgot all about that. That's right. She's, and it's almost like a regal authority that she carries in, well, in
and
that
she's
series.
Authoritarian too at that point. She's like the general-ish.
Is she White Diamond?
No, she's Yellow.
Oh, she's Yellow Diamond.
So she doesn't control people, but she forces everybody to go around. So Steven Universe, definitely approve of Steven Universe. But back to Patti LuPone, yeah, she's been Anything Goes, Gypsy, Sweeney Todd multiple times, Company, and she's won Tonys, and she's been acting for ages. So it's like,
I have her for a lot of, it looks like a lot of TV. Well,
yeah, she does onesie twosies on TV as well too, because
scratch most of that, I had to click see all, never mind.
Yeah. But she for the most part has been stage. It's a lot of stage.
Yeah.
Which is again an entirely different beast, and this is years of me knowing Patti LuPone and people standing and screaming and cheering, and it's like saying Ethel Merman. It's Patti LuPone. Like, yeah. That's the
name carries a lot of gravitas to it in terms of her ability to perform, period. Whether if it's, you know, musically, acting, even just being her. Like, she is somebody who carries with her a huge just sense of credibility to who she is as a artist, I guess the best way to put it.
I mean, she's the original West End cast Fontaine for Les Mis. I think it was in the 80s when they did that one.
Yeah, because they did the anniversary 25th. Reunion of that not too long ago.
They brought in a whole bunch of people. So you like musical theater, you know Patti LuPone.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Patti LuPone in this film is a very spiteful and very vindictive, yet she's crazy. Yes. Essentially, she is absolutely nuts in this movie. And it goes towards, and I don't want to be stereotypical, which is where I kind of want to throw it to Amy, who's a little bit more knowledgeable on this area. But from what I have gathered from the conversations that I've had with Amy and the nature of what she's explained to me, as well as honestly what I've learned from Miss Marvelous Miss Maisel, the nature of kind of Jewish upbringings and how a lot of the parenting styles of that typically do fall into that, you know, guilt mindset. Mm-hmm. Did this film to you bring any kind of recollection to that style of parenting? Because I don't want to be, here's the thing, I don't want to be stereotypical. I don't be like, oh, that's all Jewish households, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know, because number one, I'm not Jewish. You know, the skin's too dark. Spencer, I can say the same thing for you.
How dare you?
Why? Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you, Spencer is Jewish.
Are you 49% Jewish? So we can. But like, our upbringing pertaining to this specific type of upbringing is different. Mm-hmm. You were raised differently. I was raised differently. I don't know what, you know, Uncle Sal, you know, may have done or whatever.
I think I'm a quarter Jewish. I'm sorry. I'm doing math in my head.
Don't risk the credibility of this conversation here. She's like, actually, I'm only 11.5. The rest of me is just German. You know, no.
Not German. In my family, we're Polish.
Anyway, with your amount of knowledge
and your experience
and your family experience, is this movie kind of reminiscent of what you know?
Yeah. Yes. This is, I've lived through both direct and indirect iterations of this, not to the point that my parentage decided to fake their own death to get their point across. But yes, the...
I guess the big question is, but if they could, would they?
I plead the fifth. That should be all you need to know. But yeah, this is... Jewish guilt is not only... the guilt you normally feel, like if, oh, you did something bad and you feel sorry and you try to make up for it. This is the longstanding guilt of gaslighting, manipulation, toxic relationships, a constant drive to tell you that you should be stepping up, but that you are incapable to step up. So why are you even trying? You are constantly in a state of fear. Mm-hmm. True fear. And it sounds like it's when you experience it on a daily basis, or you come to the crux of this movie where the tipping point is Bo is as much afraid of going to visit his mother as not showing up to visit his mother. And like the sheer terror of that balance is not only palpable, but it's very true to particular types of mothers,
yeah,
who have been going through this for millennia.
Which it is something that you can attest to in terms of the information you get out of this movie. The idea of overbearing relationships do hold a sense of...
It's not even overbearing. This is just straight up manipulation.
Well, manipulative, overbearing type relationships, especially in the framework of familial, you know, it does... There are instances outside of not to diminish your statements that you just said, but like outside of that as well, like with other family, probably not to the extent, but I think the reason why it kind of always boils back to the Jewish culture of it is how much it is, you know, stereotyped within film, TV, mm-hmm, you know, it's the brunt of a lot of jokes from the perspective of people who have gone through it. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like as well within the framework of just relationships in general, this is also something that is plausible within any other type of dynamic. Maybe not to that extent, but it is, there is a fit for it with everyone. This isn't just a one size.
No, it's not a one size fits all, but this is something that longstanding suffering is a moniker and a terrible badge of honor that is worn by Jewish people everywhere that, you know, Marvelous Miss Maisel does a great job of trying to poke fun at that consistently. You know, we're Jewish. You whine or you complain, but you don't complain about anything that you can fix. You whine, but it shouldn't be the big things. It's just like, oh, it's so cold in here. And you, someone's like, oh, I could turn up the heat for you. No, no, no. I don't want to be an inconvenience, but oh, it's just, it's really cold. Like it runs the, it can run.
I feel
the
like
gamut.
You have to practice at that. Like, okay, I could shop this material and maybe say this, but could they fix it? No, I don't want to. No, it's okay.
And that's, I think that's part of like, you have ever, and I, we can transition this from just being Jewish, which this is very apparent to me that this is very Jewish parent guilt, but you can shift it to almost anybody else where, you know, you've got that one aunt, uncle, cousin, grandma, grandpa, that is just like, you're not eating, but I made you food. The grandma in Coco.
I was just going to say, I'm like, that statement yeah, alone,
that it should be
just rang thing. Bells for me. Yep. Cause that's like growing up in a Latin household.
I thought you said you were hungry.
Yeah. Well, it's yeah. It's not even that. It's not even, I thought you said it is time to eat. You don't eat. You don't eat ever. For yeah. the rest of your life. Like, it's that kind of implication.
It's that you're breaking my heart. Why didn't you come see me on Saturday? I'm dying and I'm old.
Oh, my God. Why are you trying to trigger me?
Because that's I'm sorry. Welcome to, like, the bitty version. Not I even mean, the bitty version. A version of what I go through.
I mean, in the Latin culture, just the idea. So, in the Latin culture, Latino or Latina moms typically hold a sense of ownership to boys, their children, their male boys, their male kids, to the point to where they are always the baby. They're always the one who gets away. They're always the one gets away with anything kind of thing. They're always the always in the right place, never wrong. Even if there are daughters in the family, the sons are the prize.
Welcome to my family because I'm a Mexi-Jew. That's not even a joke. Spencer, you've seen my parents.
Have you?
I think once.
Do you know what?
He's
I think
like,
I got
pushed
you just somewhere.
Mind.
We'll do the little tree and you'll be like.
But no, in Latin cultures, that's kind of the framework. So as you get older, for more, I guess, devout Hispanic families, or you know, toxic type family dynamics within the culture, you'll get people who are moms who are like, oh, you don't need a wife, you have your mom, or you know, you need to marry someone who's just like me, or things like that. Like that, those are actual conversations. But I don't know if they would go to the extent of just of creating a bombastic performance to prove that. They just roll over and say, you're killing me, and not talk to you for years on end.
I could go with that versus I'm going to call CPS on you because you didn't let me see my grandchildren. That is, well, mind you, dear listeners, that is more than twice that has been threatened at me.
Do I need to call somebody?
I call me.
Spencer is just dumbstruck. He's like, where do we go from here, guys?
Yeah, my so family Jim's sounds a lot more basic.
I think that's as much as that is a big, huge, giant sticking point in this film. Like, we're like, Jewish guilt, Jewish guilt, Jewish guilt. Your mother, you're killing me. Like, yes, it is a vehicle to have conversations about codependency, but it's also to show you a story where the title Bo is Afraid either makes you question of what or Bo is afraid of. Like, it should never feel, it doesn't feel, it, weirdly enough, the original title for this picture was actually called Disappointment Boulevard.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Wow. And it got changed up, and I was like, oh, okay, no wonder I didn't see anything about it. And it was kept under wraps for forever. But the fact that Bo is Afraid is both an opportunity to continue extending that conversation. Like, Bo is afraid of what? Hmm. Bo is afraid of, you know, insert whatever it is, or yeah. It's just Bo is afraid, period. And I was thinking about that as much as there is this ever looming presence of guilt, 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 which starts feeding in almost from the jump. Like the only time we kind of get in an experience where Bo is seemingly logical and we know kind of what reality is that initial popping out the womb section.
Yeah.
Like after that, he's no longer reliable. We know he's on medication and everything seems to be skewed. Like we can't tell, as you know, Spencer mentioned it last night, this fever dream, because nobody knows where it's going.
Yeah.
It creates and breeds such a really, it's confusion, which if we translate that back to Bo, it's confusion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. Which, go ahead, sorry.
Okay, I just want to briefly talk about confusion. It was probably the most interesting version of confusion I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
Because, like, I feel like if someone else had handled this, this wouldn't work as well as it did in this movie.
Yeah.
But, like, the constant confusion of, like, is this actually happening? What's really going on? How does this all tie together? For a brief minute, I was like, is none of this happening? And he's actually just, like, in an insane asylum and, like, stuck in his head type thing.
This is not, like, Joker all over
again. I was like, it could. But, like, yeah, like, the constant, like, bounding before of, like, you know, what is happening, what it's not, like, it holds your attention for longer than I thought it would with this movie, 3 hours.
Yeah, and you begin to, like, start seeing the machinations of what his mom has done over the course of time just start to unwind, and you become aware that this is more akin to the Truman Show. Mm-hmm. Or Synecdoche, New York, if you guys have ever seen that one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Beautiful movie. He creates essentially a whole portion of New York in a whole warehouse and lives it out there. He's directing, he's performing it, but he's literally living in it. And there's a moment in this film where you come to realize that everything that he has ever come in contact with, every part of his life, where he lives, the people that are in it that are like main players are all employed by his mom. Mm. And you come to kind of just start debating with yourself, yes, this might be a fever dream, but how much of it is a fever dream and how much of it is already prefabricated for him in this twisted sense of motherly love, if you will, to maintain his, you know, sense of some way security, or I guess enclosure, like, I guess, like, where he can stay to just not be hurt at all, or I don't know. It's because it's weird. It's like you were saying, mm-hmm. the scene when he's leaving his therapist and he's walking down and there's people that are playing. There's a little kid with a little toy boat in this little fountain thing. And right past that, because it seems all normal, and then you see people that are like selling guns on the side of the street, and they're trying to yell at this guy who's on this really, really tall building to do a flip, to jump, and he's laughing, and I'm like, what kind of world does this guy live in?
Yeah, like that was also like, because it's just so chaotic with like so many things that are not part of like our reality.
Yeah,
it becomes instantly hard to figure out, like, there's no measuring stick for the beginning of the movie on, like,
no,
what is real, what is not.
Yeah. And I think it's really difficult to kind of divide what is real, which even then that has like asterisks on it, like real as in what is already prefabricated by his mom and what is actually happening by chance to him in life. And what is a part of his fever dream? What is happening because of the medications that he's taken and he's not taking at the same time, or the ones that he's being given, you know, by different people? You know, it's all this kind of craziness. And then we get to this really chaotic yet somewhat oddly fulfilling wrap up of the man behind the curtain kind of thing, with Patti LuPone's, you know, playing the mom, revealing that she's been alive this entire time and that she's been she's paid people to do X, Y, and Z. You get like little glimpses of it throughout the movie, like the phone call that Amy Ryan Grace has, where she's like, well, I'm a mother too, but this isn't, you know, this isn't right, and blah blah blah. And then it gets interrupted by Nathan Lane saying, hey, let's do a barbecue, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of telling for, you know, what the intentions are going on behind the scenes.
Well, and that, and at that point in the movie, you don't even know that, like, that she's pulling the strings. Like, you do not have any indication that there is a man behind any curtain. It seems like if you fully gave into that this is Beau's reality, this is just kismet. Like, he, you know, happens to have his key stolen, which I'm like,
okay. And luggage.
And his, yeah, and his luggage. So he can't really leave his apartment. And I'm like, okay, totally understand that.
Nor the apartment building, because it's a key lock. So yeah, he has to.
Well, and then he has to take his medication and the water's turned off. And it's like, it's a series. It's that series of unfortunate events, not the book or the movie, that keep, it just keeps compounding. Like, it's like he's having the worst bad day ever. If you're just choosing to believe that this is his life. But then you start realizing that he gets to a point where he figures out or realizes that him crossing the street and like jamming or wedging open the door just enough to go by water, and every single person that is on that street suddenly goes into his apartment for a 24-hour orgy and locks him out and he sleeps on the scaffolding. Like, you're like,
I don't know if they had an orgy. I know
there were people that are getting freaky-leaky on the couch, among other things. And people were fighting. And there was one guy who, the guy that initially, when we see Beau coming back from the therapist and he just runs straight at the door and they're like running at each other, which I was like, oh, I've been in a situation where people will just run at you. And you're like, I don't know what's going on. I'm just going to remove myself.
Which at first glance, it looks like he's running out of fear of this person, because this person has the stereotypical look of like someone who might be dangerous. He's got tattoos all over his body. He's got tatted up eyes. He's got piercings on his nose and eyebrow.
But he also is screaming at the person that's trying to give him, oh, that's who it was. It's Amy Ryan. So it's Grace, who's giving food to people with Nathan Lane out of the back of their food truck.
Yeah.
And he gets this cup of soup. And she goes, here's some minestrone soup. You look like a minestrone guy. And he gets it and he takes three steps. He goes, it's too hot. And he throws it on the ground. And then later, when Beau gets locked out of the apartment, same guy has had a meal in the microwave. He takes it out. He's like, finally. And it's too hot. And he's throwing it on the ground. And you're like, I don't know if this person is completely right, they're present, but it makes that question of like, well, who do you trust?
Yeah.
Where is the paranoia? Like, can we trust people? Is the only safe space our tiny bubble that we think we've created for ourselves, because that's the only space that we can exert control, or we feel we have control.
Yeah.
And the keys being taken, and what the guy, I guess he's the super, says to Beau once he's like, hey, did you happen to see my keys and my luggage were taken? And what he says to him is essentially just like, everything's done. Like, looking back at it, that phrase that he says, because it's an expletive, we can't say it, is telling of, if, when you look back, is telling of the entire movie. It tells you, it is literally like the chug stamp on the paper.
It's the starter pistol at the beginning of this race.
Yeah.
And everything else that just is kind of nonsensical, it's really interesting, like the whole brown recluse infestation in this apartment building that ends up killing the guy who was chasing after him earlier in the film. And then the gentleman who's literally, I guess, just wedged himself in the ceiling while Beau is taking a bath.
The guy that was chasing him across the street initially, he was carrying a jar of money, goes, please help me, please help me, please help me, please help me, please help me. Like, he's chasing him across the street when Beau goes to get water. But he's literally like, he's parkouring. He's trying to be a ninja. We don't know. But the man is just literally wedged up in such a way that Beau has been, he was up there for hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I assume that was one of those things that didn't happen. Because I thought that Beau was using that guy as an excuse to just run from his place naked.
Probably. I mean And this movie also has an odd, let's see how we can put this, an odd
third
focus.
Act climax. Hot cha-cha.
This movie has an odd focus on Bo's testicles because for some reason...
doesn't Nathan Lane say they're distended testicles? To
yeah, me? They're like abnormally descended. Which is weird. And it kind of, you think it's just like a one-off thing,
nope.
But oddly enough, you do get a couple glimpses throughout the movie. They're big. But it, you think, okay, that's a really random thing to kind of mention. And then you get to this odd crescendo towards the middle of the last act of the film, where throughout this entire time you've been under the impression that Bo's father died while having coitus with Bo's mom, and dies.
Bo's father died at the conception of Bo.
There you go. That's the best way to put it. And so you have this kind of like odd question lingering, like, okay, is that what really happened? Is that metaphorical? Is that whatever? And then you get this instance where Bo's mom throws him into her attic, where I guess he meets a metaphysical representation of maybe who his dad is, or maybe his dad's actually that. But he is a giant penis.
Tallywhacker. Ding dong.
Pecker.
Schlong.
In the attic, like a monstrous size with two
16 foot tall. I actually looked up the Variety article when someone asked her. He's like, hey, what happened to that giant 16 foot tall puppet that you had? He goes, I don't know. It's somewhere in Montreal, I guess. And I'm like, you just left.
I feel like that's not something you just leave or like lying around somewhere. Like you're like, oh,
oh, apparently our Astor does.
But it's this huge thing, and you're left to kind of deduce whether or not if that's actually him, or if it's like the physical representation that his dad is a Richard in the, you know, insulting way, or if his whole focus on his testicles and whatnot has been kind of compounded into this metaphysical representation of what he feels all his dad is, which is just death by wiener kind of thing. You know, it's several different ways that you could kind of deduce what your own thoughts are, but it's really kind of, it takes you for a loop. Like that whole scene is just what?
Yeah, that's the what is very accurate. I mean, there's also questions of, because Patti LuPone's Mona, which is Bo's mom, explains after throwing Bo up there that this is something that he not only had asked for, but this is something that he should have known. And it simultaneously functions as punishment as well as revelation. Yeah. And it's a confusing revelation for us because, first off, it's left field 100%. I did not have that on my bingo card for 2023.
Nope.
or for any film, to be very truthful.
Or just in life in general.
Well, and then it's also the question of, is this a confrontation for Bo of what his deep-seated fears are? Because there's no way we can talk about this literal sequence without spoilers.
Yeah, so and go ahead.
Okay, so after being thrown up into the attic and locked in here, he's got the one janky like flashlight. We all know the one
that typical
like,
horror movie flashlight that
and
has
the
like
music the, did the perfect job. I was like, oh, there's going to be something really bad in this attic. What came up was not as I did not expect it. But there's also a version of, and in the credits, it's titled Bo's Twin in the Attic, which brings up a question when we talk about the reality of this. If is it an actual Bo? Is it a metaphysical Bo? Like, we don't know. But he's chained up in the attic and then sitting next, he's literally like slightly off and he's got an empty bowl and he's an old man. And then there is giant schlong dad. And he is like, my son. And you're like, Joaquin Phoenix is screaming. We're really confused. And then, of course, you happen to remember that there's somebody that is charging through the attic window who was coming to look for Bo and happens to be murdered by Giant Schlong Dad, which puts Bo into a somewhat catatonic state.
Yeah.
But you kind of, and then he gets out of the attic, and then you have Patti LuPone screaming, that's your father, that's your father, like this entire thing. And the question that I brought, like, after dissecting it far too long, because it was really just weird, I had questions of, in the attic, one, if it was real, and there was a giant, you know, wiener monster, and a brother that we didn't know about, or was it a representation of her choosing, like, this is his, the sexuality, him being a male,
her essentially locking away everything. All the parts of him that make him an individual.
Yeah.
That sense of autonomy.
And also gives him an opportunity to grow in confidence or to celebrate himself or to find himself is locked in this attic. And he is perpetually being blamed for the sins of his father, which he doesn't know because he never knew his father.
True.
And whether his father was a literal big dick or he's a literal like wiener monster, we don't know. And I think it just adds to that confusion where we're like,
I've never watched a movie where it had a giant penis puppet and I was unsure if that was real or not in the realm of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, from my perspective, I got to go with what I know. And that was pretty good practical effect work. I mean, you make a giant. I mean,
that is true.
It was really
a puppet.
It was a puppet. I mean, hey, you got to give credit where credit is due. This movie is absolutely bonkers. And it's weird because it's borderline. Like, this movie is one of those types where it literally skirts right by the line of where you think you might be understanding what's going on. Mm. And then it zooms off. And then it gets close again. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, it's coming. Yeah, I think. And then it zooms off again. And it's like every single time each act gets to a very big moment, because each act has its, every act is its own kind of section that has its own roller coaster ride. And when you hit the peak in most of those acts, you're like, oh my God, okay, is this supposed to, and then it transitions like, wait, what? Hold on, what is happening now? The fact that people die way too easily in this movie, number one.
All over the map.
And number two, the fact of how it ends, which it ends after Bo thinks he has asphyxiated his mom to the point where he probably broke her larynx and she falls over and dies, which, to be honest, it that much of time of him holding on to her, unless he literally broke her trachea, which we would have heard it, she shouldn't have fell over and died, but hence that's what happens.
She could have died of shock. She's Jewish.
He ends up walking away, walks to the water's edge, gets in a boat, floats down to this cave for some reason, like he's drawn to go into the hole of this cave, and ultimately finds himself in the center of this massive auditorium where his boat is held in place, and he's pretty much put on trial by Richard Kine as Patti LuPone sits next to him for the crimes against his lack of love towards his mother, to which he's found, I guess, guilty, and he's ultimately, his boat's blown up and flipped over, and he essentially drowns.
From the water, he returned. It's all cyclical. Sorry.
No, actually, I had to think about that. You're right.
Look at that.
this movie has no sense of giving the audience any kind of lifeboat, no pun intended, to understand exactly where it's going for the story. Even the ending, you're like, okay, so his mom's okay with killing her son. Got it.
He was already dead to her.
Okay, I assumed he had killed her and that like this misdirection of him like you not knowing what's real is like, oh, I didn't choke her that hard type thing. And like, you know, he drove off on the boat and then felt bad about it and then just tossed himself in the water.
So yeah. You're thinking it was kind of like a mental kind of self condemning.
That's what I'm guessing.
You know, I mean, possibly this movie leads itself to be carried in many different directions in terms of a translation, you know, deriving what you will from it. I honestly thought at some point in time that the majority of the people were robots. Because it's like, okay, well, she just died and she's okay. And she died and it's like,
Okay, for a brief time, I thought that the movie was trying to say most of the people he was meeting were just different aspects of himself. Ooh. And he was going around like occasionally killing parts of himself. But that fell apart like very early on. That
did. Then the third act really just sealed it for you. Yeah.
You know, and I think probably one of the most confusing parts of the entire movie would probably have to be the forest scene where the play is
the play within a play?
Yeah, the play within a play about, you know, Bo and him becoming a family man and then the storm and then the water comes and separates and he's like that whole thing really kind of threw me for a loop because I'm like, I couldn't tell if the narrator was Patti LuPone or if it was someone else.
It sounded like it was somebody else, to be very honest, which I think that was probably one of my favorite sections of the movie.
Yeah.
Not only for the practical effects, but for the way that they actually produced it. Because initially he goes out into the forest or he's run away from Grace and from Dr. Roger. And he's in the forest and he gets knocked out. And then he stumbles upon this person who takes him to the orphans of the forest, which we're coming up to it. And there is a sign on a tree that triggered something because it's a line from a musical and I can't even remember what it was. And I'm like, oh, it's a theater troupe. And because we're all sitting together.
Oh, something about the rainbow.
Yeah. And you leaned over. Eddie leans over to me and goes, it's a circus. I'm like, no, it's a theater troupe. It's a theater troupe. So the weirdo in me who's like, yes, this is feeling very Shakespearean Greek right now. Like, it's going to be dumb.
Which
I'm here for it.
It does lean into the direction of something out of Shakespeare in terms of this whole entire story. The whole movie itself is leaning towards like the edge of a Freudian slip. As you watch it, because you're like, at some point in time, the accusations that are being hurled at Bo are essentially that he gave up the gift, which
rightfully deserved by his mother,
rightfully
as
deserved,
Richard Kind which, says,
and which he like, essentially ooh. Loses his virginity to the girl of his dreams, in his mother's bed as she comes to pay her respects, but then she's also drunk, so they end up, you know, having a roll in the hay, if you will.
But that's not happening during the forest scene with the theater and the play where they put essentially everybody into a trance and they give him the forewarning that we like to blur the lines between audience and actors. And so Bo goes on this, at this point, we have to assume it's in his head.
Yeah.
He goes on this adventure of what it would be like if he was no longer shackled to the expectations or his mother's control and how he has a family. He meets somebody, he tills, like he has this essentially in like an epic saga of how
he is called Hero Bo in that form.
Oh, okay.
So it's almost like an Odyssey type, Iliad and the Odyssey kind of.
Well, it feels epic. Like the entire thing feels like it's the Odyssey, to be very honest. Yeah. Like the entire movie.
True.
But this point, I think it had some of my favorite set design, some of my favorite practical effects. The giant puppet at the end is not my favorite practical effect. He's very well done. But this was like the way things transitioned, the tone of it. It gave us a reprieve. Like we thought that there might have been one with Dr. Roger and Grace in that kind of weird space of like, oh, it's the upper middle class suburban family and they're just taking care of you and they're trying to give you all the love and support. And you're like, this is weird, but it's a step up from being alone in your crazy apartment by yourself with your super controlling mother. And then when we get to the orphans of the forest who are all like, oh yeah, we've been abandoned or whatever, and they've decided to create this community, and then that community in turn gives him almost a space for a revelation or an epiphany of like what his life could be like. It was really kind of interesting. And I was like, okay, this is really cool. And then the way that chapter essentially ends, you're just like, okay, never mind. We can't have nice things at all.
You know what's interesting? I was thinking about this. So you remember the guy who ends up picking up Bo on the ride?
The guy who just sits there quietly and drives him to his mom's house?
Yeah. I think that might be also, well, it looks like it. I don't know. The guy who's listed as Bo's attorney looks a lot like him.
It could be the same guy.
I don't know.
We don't even really get to see Bo's attorney at the end because he's tiny.
He's very far away. But that does bring me to the roundtable question.
Uh-oh.
And it's a simple one. it is. In the movie, we have seen a bunch of cameos throughout the movie that kind of give a little bit of a fun flair to what's happening throughout this entire chaotic situation. My question to you guys is, if they were to have done a close-up of Bo's attorney, who would you have liked to have seen play that role?
Who's Bo's attorney?
The guy who's sitting on the defense side when he's in the middle of the water.
Defense, so at the end.
Defense?
Yeah.
The guy who was yelling out, no, but he's actually, this is Sinat, blah, blah, blah.
What are we talking about?
So in the final act, when he's in the middle of that big arena, he's sitting on his boat, you've got Richard Kind and Patty LuPone, who are essentially the prosecution. They're on one side and they're in front of Bo where he can see them.
They're in front of the big like Jumbotron.
And the Jumbotron is over Bo's head.
Right.
Behind Bo is another platform and there's a big giant sign that says 1-800-DEFENSE and it's red and says defense and he has a defense attorney.
But he doesn't have a microphone so you can't hear him.
So he's almost like the second rate, like he's not even second rate.
Because you remember remember when somebody comes through and pushes a guy over the edge of the thing and he falls and hits the rock on the bottom and he goes splat?
Vaguely.
That was the defense attorney.
Oh.
So who would you have liked to have seen, Amy?
Then this comes into question of like, this is not an easy answer because I could just one off it and say, oh yeah, this is, you know, in IRL, it needs to be this person. But the thing is, the person that is Bo's defense is Bo. Like,
so you would like to have seen another version of Joaquin Phoenix on the other side?
Well, because then you're getting way too
you're
meta.
Getting way too meta. You're getting so way person, too into the weeds here. So this is literally supposed to be like, just a fun question. And you're like, person, well, see, hypothetically, you know, psychologically, if we're looking at what he needs to, you know, be doing as a defender.
I would like to see, what is his name? Wallace Shaw? Is that it?
Yeah.
Vincini?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would like to see him, but I would not like to see him die, get pushed off the rocks. But somebody that would be trying to be heard, but would be totally like not taken seriously no matter what, that type of energy, Wallace Shaw is really good for that type of energy.
I'm afraid to ask, but what about you, Spence?
I'm going to go with Parker Posey.
the one
that would have been amazing.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well. Yeah, I could see that. I would have liked to have seen a left field choice because we did get like Bill Hader out of nowhere. I would have liked to have seen Bill Hader as that role.
Like
he was the UPS guy and then he got promoted to defense lawyer.
I wouldn't be surprised if he actually was and he was just not credited.
Yeah. That would have been fun. I just feel like this whole movie, you can't just go into it and then see it and come out and be like, that was a movie. Like you went to go see, you know, another Trolls film.
That's
like,
coming out later.
This movie forces you to contemplate the nature of the existence of not only the characters in this movie, but your existence in choosing to go see this movie as a choice. and not feel like there was some kind of divine intervention to make you watch it. Spencer, you seem stumped here.
No, I'm calculating my thoughts. Please continue.
Well, wrapping this whole thing up, are there any last thoughts, any highlights, issues?
Let me just bring this to the table because this we're filing this under Spencer doesn't know if this is real or not. So did Nathan Lane and Holly actually have that daughter or did she just not exist?
That's a great question.
Because like she either died by eating paint, which I don't fully understand her reasonings for, or she wasn't there at all.
Well, if you also put into two kind of context for people not listening, the Dr. Roger and Grace have a teenaged, very upset, lashing out daughter.
An angsty teen.
She's not even angsty. No. She's self-harming. They have also taken in a soldier with PTSD who they medicate heavily as well as themselves. And their oldest son, Nate, had died in combat. So you're dealing with a child or a teenager who does not feel seen by parents who just keep medicating and are using the medication to also kind of keep her in control. So the question of yes, maybe is the only option I can give you, because at this point, all we know is everybody's medicated and everybody's fine.
It feels like you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of Bo kind of almost overcoming portions of his childhood in a sense, because the whole angsty teen thing, moving past that and that young lady actually dying or whatever that died in that particular act. And then, I mean, you would assume that the very determined and, you know, murdersome PTSD guy looked like he killed himself after he landed on his own gun.
I mean, but like, I don't know if he's real either. So like, here's the problem is that, while we're at their house and like, you know, something's up, like Holly whispers into his ear, you should watch TV and turn to like channel 78 or whatever. And he does. And it's like a camcorder of him, but then he fast forwards it. And he goes forward in the movie on the TV, but only to certain parts.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm like, some of that stuff had that guy in it. So did that I guess that guy doesn't exist. I feel like most people in this movie don't exist.
It almost kind of seems like Bo himself isn't even real.
Yeah.
Like the expectation is Mona is trying to create the perfect son. And the closest thing that came to it is the one that's in the attic, but he got too headstrong and she had to put him away so that she can further test on him later. But each other iteration of Bo is just not quite him, or doesn't quite own up to the fidelity and loyalty and loving son that she wants. 'Cause you're right. It hits all those same sequences as he fast forwards it. But you don't see what happens in the in-between.
Yeah.
Which means those are parts that are determined by Bo and his decision-making. So I don't know. You can literally kind of translate this into any facet and it'll probably work. But unfortunately, our brains are not capable of, you know, revealing exactly what Ari Aster is trying to say.
Right.
Amy, did you have any complaints or highlights or issues?
Nate, who is the dead soldier in the doctor's house, he shouldn't have a saber on the wall.
Oh my God! It had to go back to military.
Sorry, it was driving me nuts.
Okay, yeah, actually, because like, I'm pretty sure they said he was in the army, but then very quickly made some sort of reference to an Air Force type thing.
So no, the 82nd Airborne is part of the army. So that was right. But the thing was that they said they were in Caracas, which isn't that in Venezuela?
I think so.
So apparently we were in a war with Venezuela, which is hilarious to me. And then the thing that I didn't see coming out of left field was, you know, they're like, oh, it's his room. Don't touch it. It's his room, blah, blah, blah. Well, we get in there and he's got everything that's all over the walls and everything. I'm like, okay, cool, fine, whatever. But at one point, after the angsty teen decides to drink the paint, Grace jumps over the bed and there's a saber up on the wall. And I'm like, that's a cavalry sword. 82nd Airborne isn't a cavalry. But she gets it down and she's like trying to charge a bow, and it made me laugh. I was like, that's not right. It was right. Weird. It could be it could be a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and move forward.
So what about you? Issues?
I already voiced all my issues and highlights. Honestly, nice. I think the biggest issue I have is not being able to deduce what exactly is the main derivative from this film that people are supposed to gather. And that's just probably my lack of knowledge or experience with Ari Aster or the meaning of what his whole focus is when he makes movies. But, you know, that's whatever. Yeah. So let's go ahead and wrap this thing up, and let's go ahead and go around the table. We'll start with Amy. Does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles? It should be interesting.
Everything's interesting when it comes to me. So this
the head size we have on this one.
This film does pass. It has a story, beginning, middle, and end, even though it's very odd in all phases of its moving through. And while Nathan Lane may have been quoted as saying, this is the Jewish everything everywhere all at once, no, it is not. I love you, Nathan Lane. That is a direct misquote. We might need to check that. While this is an odyssey of awkward and epic proportions, it makes you really come into question if the relationships you have with your mother are worth maintaining, or identifying issues and problems that you could maybe talk about to a therapist that isn't recording them and giving them to your mother. So with that being said, awkward is as awkward does, and confusion at the end of the day leaves me with a 2.5 out of 5 monocles for this. Wow. Because, to be very frank, I don't care how large your 16-foot puppet is. I don't want to say it.
Spencer.
Okay, so this movie does pass for me. But this movie is just a train wreck of reality and non-reality just kind of merging all together all at once. And it's kind of just a bit on the too much side. There's like lots of little bits all across the movie that I do enjoy, but like as a whole package that's 3 hours long, it's kind of a lot to be like in this constant like, let's get to the bottom of this and figure out where we're going. Like, it was a lot, because like the second Parker Posey showed up, I'm like, if you do not tell me what is happening in this movie, I'm about to lose it.
Spencer was about to lunge at the screen.
Because like it's a lot. Like, I don't think I've seen a movie that like requires me to be in high gear thinking and cross-referencing the movie that I am watching with itself for 3 hours. That's asking a bit of a lot, especially since like I immediately got home and was like, can I find clips just so I can see bits and pieces of this movie again so I can like make sure I'm on the right track? That's asking just a bit much, I think. But if you like really interesting movies to figure out, maybe it's up your alley. This wasn't quite up mine, so I think I'm going to agree with Amy on this. 2.5 seems about right for me.
There you go. As for myself, the film passes for me. It's definitely a interesting tale that has a lot of twists and turns and moments of reality mixed with fever dreams, mixed with, you know, modern takes on the Odyssey, with just some straight up toxic family dynamic manipulation and whatnot. This movie really takes you all over the place with that, and it does give you a sense of closure somewhat for Bo's story, because you're like, all right, well, I mean, the guy's dead. He doesn't have to be afraid anymore. So
possibly. probably.
So yeah, I'm gonna say it passes. And in terms of monocles, this is a little bit where I deviate from you guys, because I feel like this is the epitome of what movies are made for. They're made to create conversation. They're made to be debated. They're made to be, you know, told across the table like this and really have conflicting, you know, just derivatives from this, from the movie. And I think it did a good job at doing that. So I'm actually going to give it a 3.5 out of 5. I thought it was a really interesting take. I thought it was a really interesting tale. And you know what? I wouldn't mind watching it again just to try to see if there were little things that I missed. So
there's a lot of graffiti.
There is a lot of graffiti.
Yeah, there is.
But yeah, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosophers.com. There you can check out over our alleged 300 episodes where we have everything from action, anime, comedy to suspense, everything you're looking for. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to filmlosophers.com. Also check us out over on the socials page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There you can check out all of our latest escapades as well as our other content such as Spencer's Big Score and Jane on Scene, which is where, Amy?
The only place it's ever lived and possibly will continue to live, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only.
There you go. This movie, Bo is Afraid, is still in theaters. It is probably in a limited release, so you may have to search around, but it is currently in circulation for, you know, your local theater. So check it out. Do your research. If you get a chance, carve out 3 hours out of your day, at least 3.5, because you got to account for trailers. Go and see it and let us know what you think. Do you think we were on the mark? Do you think we were off? Do you think we were underselling it, overselling it? I mean, let us know what you think over on our on the podcast page or on wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire at any one of those places. Look us up, The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe. Check out our content. Listen to our episodes. And if you think we're worth it, give us a 5-star review. I think we've earned it.
We have.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, we're still working on that.
Yeah, you threw olives at me.
Olive juice, get it right. Olive juice. Mm-hmm. There's a difference. But yeah, check us out and let us know what you thought of the episode and let us know how we did. So, but like I said, that wraps up another awesome episode and we thank you for listening. We can't wait to see you again next week. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.